Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. At 57, Sarah Davidson, like many people, saw life's door close behind her. She was a successful screenwriter. Then the phone stopped ringing, paychecks stopped coming, and her lover walked out. So what next? Joining me now from New York City is Sarah Davidson, a contributing editor at O, the Oprah magazine. Her new book is titled Leap, What Will We Do With the Rest of Our Lives? Welcome to you, Sarah.
Thank you. It is great to be here.
Nice to have you. In your book, you coined the phrase, the narrows. What are the narrows?
The narrows is what I call the rough passage to the next part of life. And I interviewed 200 people from all walks of life for research for this book, Leap. And I found that nobody escapes. Everybody has to go through this. And it's a time when you feel like your identity is being ripped away from you. All the roles that you played, you're no longer asked to play. And who are you under these roles, and what are you supposed to do for the next 30 years?
Sounds like a sort of a traditional midlife crisis, is it?
Well, there are many transitions and crises that can happen at any time through life. But what happens in the narrow is that you are moving into the last part of life. You're no longer in the first half where you're going up the mountain. You're moving down. The end is closer than the beginning. Your body is going to go through more changes than any since you've had since adolescence. And the world no longer is excited and values you. That's just the reality. So it's particularly trying, and it's a time when you just feel lost and can't see a way out and hopeless and dark.
In the beginning of your book, you talk about that period of your life quite openly, when you felt lost, when everything you touched, you say, quote, turned brown and died. Will you read that for us, that first part of your book?
Sure. Everywhere I went, people would ask me, what are you doing now? Different things. If I told the truth, I would have said, I'm doing nothing. For the first time since college, I have no work. After 24 years and several award nominations, I can't get hired to write for television. In Hollywood jargon, I can't get arrested. I can't sell articles to magazines or books to publishers, and I don't know how I'm going to earn money. The phone doesn't ring, and I have to crank myself up and go out and hustle. And why, dear God, do I have to hustle at this age? It's humiliating. During this same period, my lover of 7 years, a cowboy artist I'd expected to spend the rest of my days with, rides off with no discussion. My children, who have occupied my first thoughts on waking and my last before falling asleep, they're going off to college. As long as they lived with me, I got up at 7 and made pancakes, drove them to school, soccer, little league, ballet, music lessons, helped them write their papers and do research on Egyptian history, and carve pumpkins for Halloween. No more. My kids, my lover, and my livelihood are being yanked from me at once, and there is nothing I can do. When I tell this to a friend, Peter Simon, the photographer, he says, oh, honey, you've got money problems and no sex. That's not good.
You then continue to write about your own transition through the narrows, as you call them, and it was painful. What happened, Sarah?
How did I get through it, you mean, or what
yes.
more happened?
Well, you moved from California to Boulder. You tried doing something you'd never done before. You tried teaching. You worked in a hospice, among other things.
Yes, I was it became clear to me that my life in California had come to a dead stop. You know, there's very few moments in your life when you're free to pick up and move from one state to another. Usually you have a family or a relationship or a job or something that is tying you to that place. But suddenly I had no ties. There was no life for me there, no work. I was sitting alone in this house with no work and no kids. And I felt, well, I'd like to move, but I had no idea where to move to. And I was just kind of, I don't know, waiting, listening, trying to see if what would come to me about where I should move. And I was literally sitting alone one night listening to music, and the word Boulder came to me, Boulder, Colorado. Now, I had never been to Boulder. I don't know why it came to me. I didn't know anybody there, but I went online and I found that it had 300 days of sunshine a year, and I'm a California girl. I need the sun. And it was close to sports I love, and it had a university with a department of journalism, and it had a thriving spiritual community, which was important to me. So I wrote a letter cold to the dean of the journalism school asking if he needed anybody to teach creative nonfiction, literary journalism, which is what I consider my forte. And at first it seemed like, you know, it wasn't going to go. They have tons of people who want to teach in Boulder, and they'd never heard of me, and they didn't care. And then it so happened that there was one woman there who had taught some of my pieces in her classes. And when she found out I was walking around the halls trying to figure out what I was doing there, she said, oh, my God, we've got to get you here. We've got to figure out a way for you to come. And she arranged for me to be a visiting writer for one semester. So I thought, okay, I'll go for 3 months and see what happens. Well, at that point, things started to shift and move. You know, I call it repotting yourself, kind of like repotting a plant. When everything's turning brown, it's a good idea to give the plant, in this case yourself, new soil, and who knows what might grow.
You talk about a conversation along those lines with a high school teacher that you had, I guess, during this time, where he asked you, if you knew the world was going to end in 2 days, what would you do? You said,
yes, that was a fateful conversation, because I must tell you to backtrack a second. When I started researching LEAP, I thought I needed to find a new vocation because I was a writer nobody wanted to hire. And I tried teaching. I tried working as a volunteer in hospice. And I never had the feeling that I was doing what I'm meant to do. You know that feeling when you're just running with the current and it just feels like this is what you're supposed to be doing? I never had that feeling. And I was floundering around, and this old friend, a high school teacher, said, if you knew the world was going to end in 2 days, what would you do? And without thinking, I said, take notes. Even if it was going to end, maybe, you know, I wanted to record it because that's what I love to do. Even when I go on a holiday, I mean, I take notes because putting an experience into words makes it more real for me. And that's the way I feel most alive, and I'm using my gifts.
And so you tell the story then after that of spending the next couple of months writing a story for a prestigious magazine. And the editor called you one day and said, I can't tell you why, but don't submit anything to us anymore. And you talk about the process after that, about the creative work and how that was really what you wanted, not the fact that you were publishing in a prestigious magazine or doing something important. I want to read this bit from your book. You say the imperative was to shift from creating for a purpose to creating for the joy and the challenge of the undertaking. I began to accept that whether I'm writing for my blog or a national magazine, volunteering at a community radio station, or being paid by a network, the creative work itself is what I need, as I need air. You say it's a daily struggle. How did you change your mindset?
It's an ongoing thing. There's not one click and it's done. It's a daily thing of reminding oneself the reason I'm doing that is because I love doing it, and that's the reward. It's making this shift from, you know, writing for an outcome, in other words, to get money, to get read, to get famous, whatever, to writing for just the joy and challenge of the undertaking. And that's, you know, it's interesting because I know a lot of writers, Jane, who, when we were young, We hated writing. It was tense. I'd be tied up in knots every time I had a deadline, and it was torture. But at this point, we've done it so much, and we have kind of a trust that no matter how blocked or you seem, if you just sit at that desk long enough, something will break through, and you'll figure it out. And once you've got something on paper, you can fix it. I have a sign on my desk that says, "Anything can be fixed." And we've fallen in love with the process of writing. And it's kind of bittersweet because it's wonderful, and yet why couldn't it have happened when we were younger?
My guest is author Sarah Davidson. Her new book is Leap, What Will We Do with the Rest of Our Lives? She's also the best-selling author of the 1977 generational guidepost Loose Change, which was the basis for an NBC miniseries. And she was the co-executive producer for the TV show Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. Sarah, you say you interviewed more than 200 people who are going through the narrows, as you call them. First of all, what's the average age to pass through the narrows that you found?
It can happen as early as your 40s. In fact, I've gotten some emails from people who read an excerpt of Leap, and they say, "I'm only 32 and I'm in the narrows." But what I'm really, the particular passage I'm talking about happens roughly after 50 and before 80, somewhere in there. It's when your kids, you've raised your kids, and you've made a mark in a field, and this is the interesting thing. There's a new life phase that didn't exist generations ago. It's a 30-year period when you don't feel old, but you've done your major work on Earth. So what is this life period about, and what are we supposed to do with it?
And you say every person that goes through the narrows, they go through it according to their own character. What did you mean by that?
Well, I tend to be a worrier, and I went through it kicking and screaming. I knew people who actually welcomed it. It was hard for me to believe, but they say, "I like this dark place. It's kind of velvety like the night sky, and anything can happen. It's just an opening." And I had a friend who was a comedy writer, and she went through it cracking jokes. And she, the way she put it was, "I told my life story to everybody, including the checkout guy at the supermarket."
Are you saying essentially just open up, let it go, whatever comes, take it and run with it? Don't try to stop it.
I think the hardest thing for all of us humans to accept is that in the big things in life, we don't have any control. We don't control, you know, when we're born, when we die, what kind of children we have, what they choose to do. And facing that and realizing that there are certain big things that we are not going to be able to control, particularly the deterioration of our bodies.
Right. You say if you don't do it voluntarily, the world or your body will force you to.
Exactly. I mean, I love to ski, but I don't ski as aggressively as I did 20 years ago. I'm more careful.
I want you to tell some stories from your book, Sarah Davidson. You interview regular folks and some of the more famous voices of your baby boomer generation. Tell us about Carly Simon and your conversation with her and her journey through the narrows, as you call them.
That was so interesting, you know, because we look at people like Carly Simon and we think they've got it made. They must have some special dispensation. They don't have to go through this misery that the rest of us do. But I heard that Carly was going through some hard times. She was diagnosed with breast cancer and had a mastectomy and chemo at the same time that her record company was dropping her. I mean, they called her a heritage artist. In other words, an old clunker. And she and her husband were moving apart, and her kids were gone. Mm. And suddenly she's fighting for her life and is all by herself. And she went to live in her summer house in Martha's Vineyard during the winter when it's deserted and gloomy. And she created in her daughter's old bedroom a recording studio. And I was really impressed that she learned how to work all those machines. You know, she had tracks, drum machines and mini tracks, and she learned how to lay them down and do all the engineering herself.
Staying up late, sometimes all night, just to please herself, she said.
Yeah,
what she'd been doing when she was 19.
Yeah, she told me, "I was just trying to make music I love. There was no record company executive telling me, oh, it's not commercial, it won't sell. I just wanted to please myself. That was the only star that I could follow."
And the outcome of her path in that way?
Well, this one album she did called The Bedroom Tapes was released. And then shortly after that, she did another record. Actually, it's silly to call them records now. It shows my age. called Moonlight Serenade. And it was number 10 or something on the Billboard list the week it came out, and all the trade papers were saying, icon, Carly Simon is back.
How sweet it was, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
but
unexpected,
she knew,
too.
Yeah, she knew that, you know, this is borrowed time, you know, that to have a hit record at this age is like a little miracle, and just enjoy it. It's a gift. And she told me something that so struck me. She said, I want to learn how to walk down the ladder gracefully. What a gorgeous image. I can just see her. She's so tall and willowy and elegant. But I said, have you ever seen anybody go down the ladder gracefully? And she said, no. There's plenty of people who've tried to cut off the feet of everybody who's going up. Mm-hmm. But I want to learn to do it gracefully.
And get smaller and smaller in a relevant way, I think, is how she finished that quote. I love that. Tom Hayden. Yeah, go ahead.
To me, though, my whole orientation has been upward. You know, I'm into climbing the mountain. And the idea of sliding down or walking down gracefully, which to me like felt like turning a freight train around. Hmm.
Tell us your conversation with Tom Hayden, because he describes his own shattering, quote, shattering transition through the Narrows in a very different way.
Yes, he had been in the California legislature for 18 years, and he had to retire because of term limits. So he ran for city council in Los Angeles, and for the first time, he lost the election to a man half his age who campaigned under the banner, a new generation of leadership, out with the old, in with the new. And shortly after losing this election, by a very small margin, I think it was 50 votes or something, he suffered heart failure, and he was in the hospital having a quintuple bypass on 9/11. And as the Twin Towers were, excuse me, as those planes were hitting the Twin Towers, he was fighting to recover not only his health but his zest for living. And he fell into depression. A lot of people do after heart surgery. And his transition that he made, he said, I had to learn that it's time to put your career drives down.
But he also said not a day goes by that he doesn't have a conflict about that.
That's true. As I was saying, it doesn't just happen. You don't just make it a decision and then that's it. You have to remake it and rethink it and revisit it and give it strength and practice. Mm. And for him, he says, I still care intensely. I want to read. I want to write. I want to speak out. And he's mentoring and teaching young people to care about politics.
What about some of the less famous voices in your book? Ed Wayne is a wealthy CEO who leaves his job and does what?
Oh, I loved Ed Wayne's story. It was one of my favorite interviews in Leap. He was this guy, this scrappy guy from Houston who built his own company that manufactured oil valves, and he made it the most successful company in its field. And he got to be in his 50s and realized his kids weren't interested in taking over the business. He'd done it a long time. It was time to go. And he said, you know, do it while you're healthy. So he sold his company quickly. And then he said, the good news was I sold my company. The bad news was I sold my company.
Now what?
Now what? And he was floundering a lot because Houston, he said, is a city like Los Angeles and probably like most big cities where everybody's concerned with what you do and how much money you're making. And he was doing nothing and not making money, which had been his life's devotion. And he was actually sitting watching television one night, and he saw refugees from Bosnia packed in trains, you know, getting off in Macedonia. And the newscaster said there were no refugee camps, there were no resources in place to help these people. Hmm. And he turned to the woman he was sitting with, and he says, I'm going there. And she said, when? He said, as soon as possible. And she said, why? And he said, I want to be helpful, even if it's just handing out blankets. And a week later, he flew there and volunteered with one of the refugee associations. And then he decided, I don't want to deal with organizations and red tape. I'm just going to do what's needed. And he got this idea. He spent his own money, cost him about $10,000, to buy 8,000 red plastic buckets and fill them with toiletries that people need, like toothpaste, toothbrushes, soap, laundry soap, feminine items, baby powder, baby diapers. And then he drove into the hills where the refugees were living in these squalid huts, and they had nothing. They'd had to get out with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And he would give them these red buckets. And he said it was a little nothing, but it was something when someone has nothing to give them this. And he said it made me feel so good. And I realized that this is what I want to do with my time left.
And Sister Angele, a Reformed Jew who managed opera singers, had an interesting transition through the narrows, as you call it.
Yes. I must say I loved every person I interviewed for Leap. I loved every interview and I learned from it. So this was another favorite. Sister Angele had been named Joyce, and she was a representative for opera singers. And she'd been raised Jewish, but some people in her family had actually converted to Catholicism. And whenever she was traveling in Europe, she found herself drawn to the great, beautiful, awesome cathedrals and churches. And she would sit there and she said, I just began to feel this love for Jesus. And she began visiting an abbey in Connecticut, a wonderful women's abbey, the Abbey of Regina Laudis, where they sing Gregorian chants and they make cheese themselves that wins awards. And every woman there had made her commitment later in life, not when she was young, but after she'd already been in the world. So Sister Angele was drawn there, and eventually she took vows at the age of 50 and is a cloistered nun.
How will baby boomers pass through these years differently from, say, previous generations, would you say?
Oh, boy. Well, for one thing, most of us are workaholics. I mean, we have worked hard always, and we've defined ourselves by work. You know, when I was growing up, my father quit work, and he was home at 5:30 at night, and we had a family dinner at 6. I don't know anybody now who leaves their work at 5. You know, it was the old 9 to 5. Yeah. Everybody works a lot, and they work on weekends. And you know, wherever you go, people say, what do you do? Mm-hmm. That's our identity.
Right.
So we are a generation of type A workaholics, or many of us are. And even people who chose to be homemakers, you know, they were super homemakers. They did a fabulous job, and it was their vocation. And suddenly, if you don't have the kids and you don't have the job, they don't want to stop. Nobody I talk to, with few exceptions, wants to stop being creative and connecting and being part of the flow of life. They don't want to go off somewhere and just play golf and fish. I mean, it'd be wonderful to do that for a month, maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months. But 30 years? Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Many callers lined up to join our conversation. Sarah Davidson. Clarissa is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hello, Clarissa. You're on the line.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Hello, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
I just wanted to call and thank your guest today for her comments and her book. I am 33 and a half years old, and I have experienced almost exactly what she described, which is why I felt compelled to call. What I would love to hear her expound on is, during this phase, the narrows, how did she maintain her sense of self, her sense of inner fortitude, and what did she find really mattered when all was said and done?
Great question, Clarissa.
I'll hang up.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yes, that's a great question, and I have to tell you, I lost it. I really lost it for a long time, what felt like forever. I didn't know who I was and what my strengths were, because the world was telling me I was nobody and I had no strengths. And one of the things that helped me a lot is, for the first time in my life, I learned to meditate. I'd always felt I couldn't sit still. I just couldn't handle it. And that was a great help in getting in touch with one's inner resources and inner calm. And the other thing that I wanted to say before is that people kept telling me, you need to surrender. That was the advice I got from counselors and wise people. And I hated the word surrender. I hated the whole notion. To me, surrender means giving up, being a victim.
Quitting.
Quitting. And I'm not a quitter. I never quit anything. And I resisted it. And every time somebody said it, I just cringed. And then something interesting happened. When I was about to turn 60, a group of women in Boulder, my new adopted town, said, oh, we should put on a ritual for you. And I said, yeah, I don't think so. I mean, what is there to, you know, look forward to, getting older and feebler and dying? I just, nah. But the more they talked about it, the more they kept saying, well, we need to, you know, just give you some support and let you know that you've got friends and you're not alone, and push you into a new energy about this. And I thought, well, what could it hurt? And it went on for like 8 hours. We met at 4 p.m. and didn't leave till midnight. And they asked me to speak frankly about where I was and what I wanted and what seemed to be happening. And again, the word surrender came up. And when I said I hated that word, there was one woman who said, you know, I've thought about this a lot. And surrender that I'm talking about, it's not giving up. It's not being a victim. It is opening your arms. And when she did this, she opened her arms like she was about to embrace a lover or running to greet a little child and pick that child up in her arms. And she said, you open your arms to what's not known. It's like you say, life, you know, okay, hit me with your best shot. Whatever it is, I'll take it. And I'm strong enough to get through the unpleasant things, and I'm joyous to discover what beautiful things will come. But I can't control it, and I don't know. And okay, I'm here, and I accept.
Jane is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi, Jane and Sarah. I'm so glad you are talking about this. It takes my every moment of my everyday. It's on my mind. I got to my 60th birthday last year and am really struggling with who I'm going to be in this world. And I'm very interested to hear all of what you're talking about. I wanted to ask in particular, because you haven't really talked about much about the loss of your lover, and related to that, the difference between men and women at this particular time in life, and they're going through the narrows, if you had those discussions, and I'm really looking forward to reading Leap and hearing all these experiences, but would appreciate hearing your ideas about that.
Jane, thank you. Good question. How do men and women deal with the narrows differently?
Well, first of all, just as many men have to face this as women. Some people think it's more for women, but it isn't. It's everybody. I mean, Tom Hayden said it's hard for men who want to lead and govern and minister to just kind of lay all that down. And I said it's hard for women, too. What I would like to do, and the reason I wrote Leap, is that I would like to galvanize people to create new models of growing older. We can be of use. We have more time now. We have so many talents and skills, and there's so much to be done in the world that I think there's a wonderful opportunity here to make a difference.
George is calling from Norfolk, Virginia, with a good question. George, go ahead.
Hey, Jane, this is George in Norfolk, Virginia.
Hi, George, go ahead.
The reason I called, in fact, right now I'm at my daughter's house getting ready for my weekly tutoring in French. She's helping me learn a new language.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 68. I heard on the radio that your guest had interviewed 200 people, and all of them were pretty much said things of similar nature. I'm surprised that of that many people, she didn't find some that were more optimistic and were leading a better life than what my impression was from what she was saying.
George, thank you.
I've got a lot of friends.
Yeah.
Friends who apparently have not gone through this, at least they have. I don't know anything about it.
Let's ask Sarah. George, thank you for your call. Does everyone go through this? Many are like George. They're very happy. They don't feel anything like this.
Yeah, George, I think it's great that you're learning French. One of the ways to keep your mind active and to keep your spirits up is to learn something new, something that you might be scared you can't do or that seems overwhelming. What I meant when I said that everyone has to go through the narrows is that our bodies are changing and we're going to have to shift gears. And that alone is huge. And as I said before, everybody goes through it differently. Some people are very optimistic, and they take it as an opportunity. It's your attitude. Everybody has to go through this transition, but they do it with very different attitudes. And some, like you and your friends, are just making the most of it. Unfortunately, I did a lot of kicking and screaming because I wasn't as optimistic.
Sarah, the New York Times had this to say about your book. They said that you're on to something here. But they also said that LEAP is staged on a hill of privilege high above the success line, that failures, drug burnouts, and major health problems are not part of this equation that you speak of unless, and they talk about being over the hill is not what it used to be. Is your book for a particular class of people, a particular status of people? Does it really apply to a broad audience?
It applies to a very broad audience. However, I say in the book that this is not about people, and there are so many of them, and my heart goes out to them, who are struggling with poverty, who are don't have health insurance, who don't have options, who have to keep working and maybe don't have the privilege or the option of regrouping and doing something else or volunteering. And I'm very sensitive to that. And for those people, this would be cake and ice cream, you know, to have these problems, like how do I find meaning and purpose in the next part of life? But that doesn't negate the fact that we have a huge cohort of people who are going to turn 50 or 60 and be in excellent health and wonder what it's for, what this time is for. And, you know, whenever you're going through a transition that's difficult and you feel depressed and gloomy, it doesn't help for people to tell you, well, you know, people are dying in Afghanistan. You have it fine, because that makes you feel worse. Then you start beating up yourself. Why am I feeling bad when, in fact, I am lucky and I should be grateful? But when you're depressed, when you're going through a severe transition, and everybody goes through them at some point, it's like Sylvia Plath said, it's like there's a bell jar over you. You can't see, and the air is stale, and it's real. So I think there's a huge number of people that this applies to.
Back to the phones, this time to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Liz is on the line. Liz, hello.
Hi, Jane. I'm calling because, I'm a 44-year-old woman with 18-month-old twins. So I'm wondering how I fit into this model. And I have many, many friends who, you know, had kids in the late 30s, early 40s. And I think it's somewhat of an epidemic at this point, especially for professional women, either adopting or having babies late in the game. So I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, she talks about creating a new model to grow older. Well, I certainly am going to have to find a different way to grow older when I have little toddlers running around.
Liz, I'm with you. I fall into that category. Sarah, what about us?
I do, too. I had my kids at 39 and 41. So, I think while you're raising your children, you are so focused on that. There is so much to do and absorb you and concentrate on and think about, and the children need so much, and they need it all through their, I mean, they never stop needing it, but they definitely need it all through high school. It isn't just, you know, I always laugh when people say they're taking a maternity leave, because that's kind of the easiest part. It's when they're running around, as you say, and when they have needs and when they have problems that you really need to be on board. And I don't think you really hit the narrows until your children are off on their own. And then, you know, the question is you're going to be in your 60s.
And then what?
And, yeah.
Spokane, Washington, we go to Carrie. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Sarah. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'll be 60 this year. And after 10 years of pursuing a non-traditional career for 20, I was slam dunked from my dream job. Then I was rescued by a knight in shining armor, retired at 50, and I'm home alone. I've found that I've been able to pursue my passion for trees for the past 5 years, and you create a new circle, gain new life, and you actually do something. And if your passion isn't trees, then it could be anything else. So what kinds of passions did you discover in your book?
Sarah Davidson?
Yes, it's all about passion. And, you know, when you're in the depths, you don't feel any passion at all. That's what makes it hard. And you just kind of have to be patient and realize that if you can just keep breathing and accept that this is a transition and it will end. I met people who are doing the most fabulous things, like you with the trees. I know a couple, a doctor who has a thriving practice, and he closed it and went to Uganda, where he's working on the AIDS crisis. He's building a hospital there. He's teaching doctors how to treat people with AIDS. And not only doctors, but nurses and lay people are becoming adept at treating, and there's so much need. And he's also starting a program at a medical school to have interns do a rotation where they do third world medicine. So I met a couple who were 61, and a child came to them out of the blue, a child that needed to be adopted, but the child's mother had syphilis, so none of the parents on the list for adoptions wanted to take a risk. But these two people knew. They did the research, and they found out that the syphilis had been treated and cured in this young baby. And they agreed to be temporary foster parents because nobody wanted this child, and they fell in love with the child. They, after a month, they said, well, you can't just take him away, and we know we're older than you're supposed to be, but would you consider us since nobody else wants this child? And Jane, who actually that was the name of the woman, said to me, we asked ourselves, what was the most fulfilling, wonderful part of our lives so far? And it was raising our children. So why not do that at this age? And of course, they had to make arrangements with their grown children, and that if anything happened to them, they would take this child.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones for another call from Andover, Massachusetts. James is calling this time. James, hello to you.
Yes, hello. I just turned 61. Actually, I retired about 5 years ago from the high-tech industry, where I had a pretty good job and a pretty good salary. But I seen the writing on the wall, and I decided to take the early pension that was offered. And my desire had been to go into academia when I was working industry, and I did. I actually spent several years in some rather questionable secondary, post-secondary educational schools before finally getting a job offer from the university. Now my concern is at 61 is as to whether I should pursue a PhD or whether I should listen to my 58-year-old wife and not pursue that PhD.
Too late for a PhD, Sarah Davidson.
It's never too late for anything. And I think what you need to do, and this is something we all need to do, is really get in touch with your inner guidance, yourself. You know, there's... when you're struggling, trying to figure out, should I get a PhD or should I just do what I'm doing? Is it too old? You go through all the reasons, but I don't think we make decisions for reasons. I think we make decisions based on kind of an inner compass that is telling us what we really want to do, and listen to that. And if it's telling you get a PhD, you go, guy.
Let me turn for a moment and change the topic just a bit. In your book, you describe the boomer quest to stay looking great. Chapter 4 is titled The Body Electric. And I wanted you to read a bit from that, if you would, Sarah.
But how can I learn to stop worrying and love the bomb, my aging body? Today I found gray in my eyebrows. And what are those? Jowls? A friend used to say when we were in our 30s that there had to be an age, 60, 70, when we could give up and pig out. But I'm afraid this is not going to be. I weigh myself still every day, and I try mostly in vain to eat smaller portions. My first husband used to say, a thin girl is a happy girl, and that still holds for this reporter. Whoopi Goldberg says she was shocked when she found that my rear end is bigger. She looked behind her and said, what's that? I'm being stalked by my own rear end. Men worry about an expanding stomach and dwindling hair, and we worry, well, about everything. What to do? Work out compulsively? Have your hair dyed and cut in the latest 20-something style? Or go defiantly gray? If I start wearing a Wonder Bra and have my eyelids done, will I feel embarrassed as if I'm cheating, trying to deny what's happening and failing to make this transition gracefully? Or is it natural, even admirable, to want to look as attractive as you can for as long as you can? In the spring of 2004, I was given an assignment to explore physical aging with women who've been famous for their bodies. I'd managed to resurrect my magazine writing career, although it still felt tenuous since only a few were giving me work, and I was intrigued when, oh, the Oprah magazine asked me to interview actresses and supermodels who'd owned the IT body 20 or 30 years ago. Cheryl Teagues, Christie Brinkley, Farrah Fawcett, Iman, Jane Fonda, Jane Kennedy, and Raquel Welch. These women had lived by their looks. And the loss of their near-perfect, youthful figures must have felt catastrophic, like me not being able to write. How did they adapt? Had they learned, as Carly Simon's mother did, to see beauty in a withered, arthritic hand? Had Jane Fonda, who's always on the cutting edge, found a way to accept her aging thighs? And if so, could she please tell me how?
So what did you discover, Sarah Davidson, about physical appearance and the inevitable changes that come?
Yeah, I think everybody comes to their own decision and there's no one answer. And I spoke with Thomas Moore, who wrote Care of the Soul, and asked him, what do you think about women who, you know, get a navel ring like their teenage daughters when they're 50? And he said, I can't put a judgment on that. If you're doing it because you feel lively and you want to keep a youthful heart, so that's fine. If you're doing it because you can't face the fact that you're aging, that's not so good. And you can do two things at once. You can say, I'm going to get older and do it as gracefully as I can. And you can say, I want to look as young and good as I can for as long as I can. It's sort of like maintaining a building that's aging. You want to keep it looking good. So with the right attitude, you can do whatever you want.
You say there is one thing that determines whether you suffer or you have joy in the years ahead. As you go through these narrows or after you're out of them, what is that?
I would like the listeners to think a moment. What's the one thing that you think will determine the most important thing, whether you have a good time or you're miserable in the years ahead? And what I found is that it's change, your relationship with change. Do you fight it or do you find a way to roll with it and accept it and even turn it to your advantage? Everything is going to change. And one spiritual leader said we need to practice change because the ultimate change we're all going to face is dying. So we need to learn and practice how to be content with change.
At the beginning of the book and the beginning of our conversation today, we talked about the difficulty in your explaining to people or answering the question, what do you do now when that's asked of you? So what do you say to that now? And what do you tell women and men about their answer to that question?
I say the truth, whatever it is. I was embarrassed at that time to say I was doing nothing because then nobody's going to want to hire you. But the interesting thing is that I'm in the same situation today as I was when I entered the Narrows. I have no idea what work I'm going to do after I finish with this book. And I don't know what companions are going to be with me. And the difference is that I'm not fighting it. I'm not raging against it. I'm not feeling sorry for myself because I've found that the country that's ahead from all the scouting I've done is rich and unpredictable. It's going to be a full spectrum. And importantly, I think I've learned to be half in love with uncertainty.
Sarah Davidson has been our guest. She is author of the new book, Leap, What Will We Do With the Rest of Our Lives? Sarah Davidson, it's been good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if people want more information, they can go to www.sarahdavidson.com.
Thanks so much. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Yesterday